Coming up on Boston Public Radio, $20 a month if you buy healthy food at the supermarket? Count me in. A new program at Harvard Pilgrim does just that. Would it cause you to change your habits? Then Callie Crossley on 50 years after Mississippi's Freedom Summer and the taxi versus Uber battle in Cambridge and across America. Then Larry Hott joins us. His documentary on WGBH2 tonight is on the life and work of the genius Frederick Law Olmsted, who brought us the Emerald Necklace, Central Park, and revolutionized how we live in cities.
Emily Rooney on the Olympics coming to Boston. South Boston is complaining this time about the Whitey Bulger movie, plus her famous list of observations and complaints. Then a Friday news quiz with a tattoo artist and a guy who photographed tattoos commemorating Boston's recovery from the marathon bombing. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
19 hours till summer, but who's counting? In any case, hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
So what would it take to get you to buy healthier foods? If knowledge is power, do nutritional labels give you the strength to do the right thing? Does knowing that a soda has 250 calories really give you the resolve to drink water instead? I know what's healthy and what isn't, and I bought a box of donuts this morning, but if WGBH gave me a cash incentive to buy a bag of apples instead, would I? Well, that's what Harvard Pilgrim is doing. They're giving cash rewards, $20 a month specifically, to their employees for eating healthy food. We're going to get your take on this in a couple of minutes. But first, let's find out how effective these kinds of programs are. We're joined by Leslie John. Leslie's an assistant professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. She's done research in the area of health incentives. Leslie, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, Leslie. So what do you think? Do things like this actually work? I don't know. $20 a month doesn't seem quite enough to me, but I don't know. What do you think?
So I think I love the spirit of the program. I think it represents an exciting area where the incentives of insurance companies to reduce healthcare costs are very nicely aligned with consumers' motive to be healthy. Now, will it work? Well, I think it depends a lot on how you define success. So if you define success as paying people to buy healthy food, then I think that it will probably, using this narrow definition, there's a good chance that it will cause people to buy more healthy foods when they're at the qualifying stores using their loyalty cards. Now, the broader question of whether it will actually cause people to be healthier and lead to meaningful improvements in their health is a much more complex question. And for that, I would say this program is unlikely to hurt people, but it's unclear whether it will have a big improvement, whether it will foster a big improvement.
Why is it unclear? There's a Harvard study, it's quoted in the Globe this morning. You may actually have done it. A 2010 Harvard analysis, quote, found medical costs fall $3.27 for every dollar spent on workplace wellness programs. So it sounds like, by definition, people get healthier when companies pay for the gym and these sort of things. So where's the disconnect in your mind, Leslie John?
Yeah, so the disconnect is in a lot of research on looking at food consumption and trying to, so to speak, nudge people into eating healthier foods. When you use an incentive, when you say pay someone to buy healthy food as they're trying to do here, it's unclear whether there are sort of unintended consequences of doing so. For example, here what might happen is when you are being tracked through your loyalty card, to this program,
exactly,
you know, then you behave. But then when you want to buy the bad stuff, you just don't use your loyalty card or you go to a different store.
Exactly.
That's a great point.
Exactly what I was thinking. I'm going to behave myself at Shaw's and Stop and Shop or wherever I've got my card. And then I'm going to go buy my heavy cream to put on my blueberries at the 7-Eleven.
Exactly.
You know?
Now, there is some lab research that suggests that when you behave in a virtuous way, so for example, when you buy healthy food, then you subsequently exhibit a licensing effect whereby you're then more likely to then misbehave. Now, so that would suggest that this could actually backfire. I don't think that my intuition is that that won't happen. My intuition is that if anything, this will help people, but it's really unclear whether it will help them to eat healthier. But I think that those lab experiments that show this sort of paradoxical effect, they haven't really been shown to generalize. It's unclear whether they generalize to the real world, so to speak.
We're talking to Leslie John from Harvard Business School. One last question from me, Leslie. How do people like these insurance companies or people like you, when consulted, answer the question of how much is enough? Meaning, is it $20? Is it $40? And the flip side is it better to offer a positive incentive like cash or to threaten with a negative consequence, meaning your health insurance costs are going to go up or whatever it is, your premium is going to go up? How does one decide what's the optimum level and whether it's negative versus positive incentive that'll do it?
Yeah, these are great questions. So for the first question on the magnitude of the incentive, so if you pay people $100,000 to do this, you know, the larger the incentive in general, the more responsive people's behavior is. However, what my colleagues and I have been finding is that a lot of what matters is not necessarily the magnitude of the incentive, but the way the devil's in the details, mm-hmm. so to speak, the way the program is operationalized. So, for example, in this case, if you get your $20 through like your monthly deposit, electronic deposit paycheck, it doesn't really feel very rewarding. It sort of gets lost in your bank account. On the other hand, if you were to mail the person a $20 bill, or even when they don't attain their goal, mail them a letter saying, hey, this envelope would have contained a $20 bill. It's empty. So you can use a lot of sort of tricks that tricks is maybe the wrong word, but in this case, you can make your incentive dollar go a lot further by understanding the psychology and not just the economics of how people respond
well,
to incentives.
Well, you know what that made me think of? You've heard this a million times, is people who are anti-tax in this country say if there was no withholding of your federal income tax and your state income tax, but rather you had to write a check to the government for the exact same amount every month, there'd be a revolution in America, which is a variation on the theme that you're talking about.
And then the final point on your last question on sort of carrots or sticks.
Yeah.
Paying if people get paid or have to pay a penalty, there's a trade-off there, because I think in general, when it's a stick, when it's a cost that people have to pay for misbehaving, it's more effective. But the rub is that it's much less palatable to people. The public doesn't accept it as much. Yeah. It feels cruel.
Yeah, it is cruel, actually, to penalize you for your heavy cream for your blueberries. Leslie, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. We usually appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Leslie Johnson is an assistant professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. She's done research in the area of health incentives. Leslie, again, thanks for being with us. We're going to open up the lines now to you guys at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Would a cash incentive work for you?
Yes.
Would you be a good doobie, or would you be sort of a good doobie and do the good thing where you're being tracked and then sneak over to buy all your bad food? Like I said, at 7-Eleven, 877-301-8970.
And by the way, we should be clear. That's how it works. You have a loyalty card or whatever you called it a minute ago. You're issued it by Harvard Pilgrim in this case.
You're
tracked. It's the first such effort in this state and one of the first in the country, not on wellness things. Things like gyms and others have been in place for a while. But you use that when you pay. They track it on some computer. But as you and Leslie John said, they don't track it if you end up going to McDonald's afterwards. 877-301-8970. Would financial incentives make it more likely for you to eat healthy? If they would, how much is necessary? Is $20 a month, $240 a year? Does it need to be more? And I guess, I wasn't even thinking of this till Marjorie said it, would you cheat? Would you cheat? The evidence would suggest, despite what you and Leslie said, this $3.27 return on every dollar spent on a wellness program suggests that these things do make you more healthy. And also, the one place where I disagree with, I wish I had said this, but I forgot about it till just now, is as someone who, as you know, has gained and lost weight about a million times in my life.
You're doing great now.
Right now I am. But when you have some good outcome, it has a psychological impact. She says the licensing effect is then you do some bad things. And she knows much more than I. But at least in my own circumstance, when you have some progress, you want to do more things that give you more progress. It sort of feeds on itself. 877-301-8970. Would this kind of financial incentive make a difference to you? I think the answer is almost without exception. Even if people say $20 is not enough, it's it's $240. And she is totally right. If you got a crisp $20 bill handed to you at the end of the month, rather than just being folded into your ADP direct deposit.
The best one is when you send someone the empty envelope and said, if you behaved, you would have gotten the $20 bill. But since you were naughty, you're not going to get it. And that's the way it is. Our number is 877-301-8970. Our email is bostonpublicradio@wgbh.com.
Oh, no, actually, whoops. I think it's bpr@wgbh.org.
I'm sorry, I always goof at the email.
But that's close enough.
We do have an email from Christopher who says he wants to know, what is healthy today? Trends in what is considered healthy change. We know sodium and sugar are bad, but now we know real fat is okay, unlike 20 years ago. Sounds like more tracking and nanny state stuff to me.
Exactly. Jeff in Freetown, you are first on Boston Public Radio. What do you think, Jeff?
Good afternoon, Fatty McJim. How amazing is it that I have not listened to you guys since you were on 96.9? I put on the radio,
and lo and behold,
talking about being healthy.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Yeah. And you should see him now. He's like a shadow of his former self.
What
He's
is that
no
about
longer.
Water rising to its own level or whatever? We're really thrilled to have you back. So what do you think about this, Jeff?
I think it's amazing. I think they should push this program out there. I, for myself, would buy more apples if I got a nice, crisp $20 bill. You know what Margie would do with that $20 bill, right?
I don't know, no.
Get those doobies she was just talking about.
Goodbye, Jeff.
But anyway.
It's a pleasure to have you back. Thank you so much.
I got a question before I go real quick.
I don't think we want to hear it, but go ahead.
So would this pertain to the people on welfare? I mean, would that be double dipping?
Well, you know, in all seriousness, my assumption is if this kind of thing works, it's a I mean, they do it in schools for kids who are middle-class kids and poor kids. Healthier eating creates all kinds. By the way, it doesn't just make you healthier in general. And thanks for your call, Jeff. We had this discussion with somebody about a week or so ago. Maybe it was Paul Toner from MTA. I don't know who we were talking to about this. Is all the research suggests if a kid eats healthy, who's in a public school or any school setting, they're going to do better in school. They're going to do better socially. So it's a trickle down or trickle up kind of thing in lots of ways.
Well, you know what? I thought everybody knew that, you know, Doritos were a bad thing and Pepsi and Coke are a bad thing. Amazingly, when we saw that documentary about the documentary
fast food thing.
Yes, a lot of people don't know.
Excuse me, Marjorie. Stop right there. I have been arguing with you for 15 years on the radio about how nutritional labels and calorie counts at restaurants make sense. Your response always is, they don't tell people anything they don't know. And
Jim,
now you're finally saying,
I am big enough to admit
you're
I
wrong.
Was slightly mistaken on that point. But did you know that pasta sauce is loaded with sugar? Or
that
bread
everything is loaded with
is
sugar.
Everything. I know it now. That almost
ketchup
I think
is
70%
hugely
of the stuff on the shelves in the supermarket is loaded with sugar. I did not know that, Jim. I admit my error.
Fine. We
Let's
have it
go
on
to
record.
Eric from Wilmington. What do you think,
Eric? Hey,
Eric.
How are you?
Hey, guys. We did a Biggest Loser contest at work where everybody put in $20.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the month, the winner got the money. So it turned out to be like $120 total pot. And the biggest everybody lost weight. The biggest reaction, I thought, was the social component. We had a weigh-in at the beginning, and then people would weigh in every week, and we wrote the weight up on the wall. So it was very apparent who was losing and who was not. Anyway, it worked really well. Like I said, everybody lost weight in the office, a fair amount, actually.
Now,
and some of the guys tried, the paleo diet, which is just like red meat.
Oh, yeah.
And they lost a lot of weight.
Eric, what about the people that didn't do that well that week? I hope their coworkers didn't make fun of them or anything.
He said they all lost weight.
Yeah, but there must have been some weeks when people didn't do that well.
Well, yeah, so one of the guys started out with a buffalo chicken salad on the first day, and he gained weight the first week, and he got made fun of relentlessly. It's mostly guys in my office, so that might be a part of why that worked out.
Hey, Eric, before you go away, I know it's hard to distinguish the two factors, but do you think it was more the collegial thing that you're all doing this together as an effort, or the cash potential that was the prime motivator? What do you think did it?
Well, I think it was both. Partly it was, there was a stack of $20 bills in the office, so you were going to get the physical cash, which was a big incentive. And then also kind of the people who were vying for the top spot were very much more invested than people who kind of fell off after the first 2 or 3 weeks. So there is a little bit of a dynamic there. But, I mean, if it was $20, I don't think it would have worked. It was a fair amount of money, though, like I said, like $140.
Yeah, that's right. And by the way, that suggests that also buttresses the point Leslie John made a couple of minutes ago, that when it's cold, hard cash and it's literally and figuratively in front of you, it does make a difference. Eric, thank you for the call.
Eric,
we appreciate it.
Was describing a lot like Weight Watchers.
I went to one Weight Watchers session once ever, and the I thought it was going to be really embarrassing. I really did. But there is, after you're there 5 minutes, I only went once because it was inconvenient, there is this communal thing that really gets you into the mindset, and I assume that's part of why they've been relatively successful. Let's go more than relatively successful.
Emily from Cambridge. What do you think, Emily?
Hello, Emily.
Hi, guys. Good afternoon. Twice in 1 week. I feel so lucky.
It's frightening, isn't it? It's great. Good to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much. I love this topic. And the reason why is because I study human motivation, and there's something called intrinsic and extrinsic motivators, right? And the cash is extrinsic. Someone is putting that value on you. Intrinsic is, I want to lose the weight. I want to feel healthier. You're doing it for yourself. So, no surprise, when it's an extrinsic motivator, it's a very short-term effect. People lose weight for a short amount of time, but they aren't committed to it to the long term because there's cash involved. Cash is what's motivating you, not what's going on inside of your own head. So,
but wait, Emily, stop for a second. By the way, are you in the business? Because you called about...
I am.
Yeah, well, that's
I am.
Good. See, let's test out my theory. I agree with you in the abstract, but my own experience has been if an external motivation gets you going and you make some progress, it begins, I know this is a horrible pun, to feed on itself, and the success causes you to internalize some of those things. And even if there's no cash down the line, even though there would be at Harvard Pilgrim, then you can internalize it. Is that not a fair characterization
of
what
point.
Often happens?
And I really liked what Eric said before about the, you would ask him the question, which factor do you think is more motivating? And I think it's the collegial atmosphere. It's the fact that people are in it together and they're motivated together. But Eric said people started falling off after a couple of weeks because they thought, oh, you know what, I'm not going to get that cash, so it's not important to me. So I think it's wonderful. I don't want to be a naysayer because something like this is excellent. But listen, we all know that junk food is bad for us and we still eat it. I don't know if $20 is going to make the difference in terms of the extrinsic motivation there.
Emily, thanks for another great call. Do it again soon. We appreciate it. Should we take one more?
Yeah, I just have a quick question for you. You might be able to address this point because there is the psychological question of why it is that, say, you are dieting and you're doing well, but you go off the wagon and you go out and you have a pizza and you eat like 3 pieces of pizza, which is much more than you intended on eating.
What's
and then
point?
You think, what the heck? I may as well eat the whole pizza.
That happens to me all the time.
Yeah. What's going on there?
What?
What's going on there?
I like pepperoni. I mean, when you have a whole pepperoni thing in front of you, and you say to yourself, you're only going to live so long. Is that what the kind of answer you're looking for? Let's take one more. Steve, no, it's horrible, but you were so right.
Yeah, you go off the wagon.
I know,
what
it's
the heck?
Sick.
I may as well
Why don't
go
you just
way
stop?
Off the
I know.
Wagon.
I'll start tomorrow. Okay. Steve in Fall River, you'll wrap this up. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you for the call.
I just wanted to say that $20 probably wouldn't be enough incentive for me to change my eating habits, but maybe if Harvard Pilgrim was able to partner with the food growers, the manufacturers, or the retailers, and maybe offer coupons of some sort on the items they want to push, then that might be something that could drag people to the stores, because I myself like the coupon for salads. I know they sell these salads. You can get a coupon 2 for $5. If that was something they could push in there along with the card that they're tracking you with, that might increase compliance.
Yeah.
Well, it's a variational theme. But also, I guess that's an interesting thing. It makes it more real because it's tied to an individual product. It's a decent idea. Thank you. We really appreciate the call, Stephen.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Up next, Callie Crossley, host of Under the Radar, joins us to go over the news that may have escaped our attention, but not Callie's. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This summer, the best artists are coming to Boston, and WGBH has your tickets.
Saltmarsh, and I don't know if you hear this, we got a little Pat Benatar.
I love Pat Benatar,
and we have tickets. We have 25 pairs of tickets. These will go. I'm Kim Saltmarsh. I'm hanging with Jim and Marjorie, and I have to tell you, I don't know if you've heard yet, but today is Final Friday. So what does that mean? It is your final chance to support Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. This is your final chance to be invited to sit in with Jim and Marjorie to see Boston Public Radio live in studio this summer. Get your name on the invite list. You only have an hour and a half to get it. We're going to select people all summer. I swear Jim doesn't bite. I swear he doesn't. You can hang with him. It's going to be great. But look, this is your final chance to get in on the BPR ticket deal of the day. Today's deal, Pat Benatar tickets, a gift of $200. We're going to say thank you so much with two free pairs, or just a free pair of tickets to see Pat Benatar. It's Blue Hills Bank Pavilion in Boston, Tuesday, July 1st at 7:30. Again, we only have 25 pairs. These are going to go so fast. So look, we're having some fun talking about hit me with your best shot. This is our best shot to fill a budget gap that we have. Let me tell you about it. We have a $70,000 deficit. We have to raise $70,000 today. We have no choice. And that's because it's the end of our fiscal year. We've got to balance the budgets for all of your favorite shows, including this one, Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. If you can give a larger gift, this is the moment. What is this worth to you? $100, $500, $1,000. This cannot happen. It will not happen without your support. We need to hear from 100 people by 2 o'clock. That's what will define success. Remember, it's your final chance to get those Pat Benatar tickets, final chance to get in on the in-studio invite list to see Boston Public Radio live and hang out with Jim and Marjorie. Let me give you the number, 888-897-9424, and online at wgbhnews.org.
I assume you know that listeners in all six New England states can access 89.7. Television viewers across the region have access, as you know, to WGBH2, WGBH X44, and on cable, WGBH World and WGBH Kids. When we say a gift of any amount matters, we really mean it. A gift of any amount does matter. But if you can swing a gift of $500 or $1,000 right now, you're helping in a really big way, in the kind of way that reaches more New Englanders than any other public broadcaster in the region, period.
So Pat Benatar, you remember some of the great songs she did in the 80s, Heartbreaker and the Heat of the Night? We're just playing one that we came in right now. I didn't know she won 4 Grammys. Did you know that?
I did not.
I mean, she's absolutely fantastic.
She's
cool. What a great night to spend watching her. First woman to play on MTV performing You Better Run. And she also had that, which I didn't even know either. She's the bestseller, New York Times bestseller, 2010, Between a Heart and a Rock Place.
Wow.
Her memoir of her life. So there you go.
She's a cool lady. And
extremely.
$200 gets you a pair of tickets. We only have 25 pairs. These are going to fly. I really hope you take advantage of them. This is the BPR deal of the day. But more importantly, we have that deficit I've been telling you about. Your support is so important. We have $70,000 to raise today. We've got to balance these budgets for your favorite shows, including this one, BPR with Jim and Marjorie. Looking to say thanks to 100 people by 2 o'clock. Your final chance to get the Pat B tickets, final chance to get in on the in-studio invite list, hang out with Jim and Marjorie, see it live. We're going to select a few people all summer, and it's your final chance to do your part. You know, you have such an impact as a WGBH supporter. You're not just getting your Pat Benatar tickets, you're not just helping great radio, but you're providing moments. You're giving Amanda in Dorchester a welcomed escape during her afternoon commute. You're doing that. You're making Ben in Nashua, New Hampshire, feel like he has a grasp on current politics when he listens to Boston Public Radio. You're doing that. And you're giving Marjorie, not this one, but another one in Winchester, a peace of mind, knowing she feels comfortable having her kids listen to the radio. That is where your contribution goes. That is what happens when you take part in Final Friday. In this moment, this is your final chance. 888-897-9424 and online at wgbhnews.org. Again, looking to hear from 100 people by 2 o'clock. Maybe while you give a listen to this.
I'm Dana from Sharon, Massachusetts, and I support WGBH because Boston Public Radio gives me information that really deepens my understanding of the world. It's intelligent and it's thoughtful and analytical with just the right dose of humor, and because it's the home of Jim and Marjorie.
You're listening to a third hour of a special edition of Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan.
Well, I've been listening to them for a couple of years now, and when they moved to WGBH, I was just thrilled because I've always thought that their brand of news analysis were more appropriate for public radio. They really pulled me over to become a supporter. I was one of those people who would flip to GBH occasionally in the car, but now I actually have it on a dedicated button on my radio. I've always believed in putting my money where my mouth is, and I've always tried to be a supporter of the things that I believe in. So now it's Boston Public Radio.
For Boston area teenagers who are too young to drive or don't have access to a car, the MBTA is crucial.
Greater Boston takes you beyond the day's headlines.
We have youth that want to basically be able to pay minimal amounts.
And presents a deeper perspective on stories that matter.
The city's $8 billion in debt. Do you just not care about that?
No, actually, we care very much about that. And actually, our coalition formed out because...
Watch Greater Boston, weeknights at 7 on WGBH2.
WGBH programs exist because of you. An innuendo featuring Hunter Douglas Duet Arcatella insulating shades for controlling the light and heat that summer brings. Room darkening shades available as well as motorized and skylight systems. Hunter Douglas at innuendo and innuendo.com. And the Boston Speaker Series presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers including Ken Burns, Madeline Albright, Dan Rather, and others. BostonSpeakerSeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Friday, is the host of Sunday Nights Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. That must be Kelly Crossley. Hey, Kelly.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Okay, Kelly, so I'm dying to talk about this. What is happening with Uber car service? It's happening all around the country.
Yes.
It's also happening in Boston, happening in Cambridge. The Globe says it has the potential to turn Cambridge into a laughing stock worldwide. What's happening over there?
Well, there was a meeting last week, and Uber did the smart thing. They packed the house by using their technology, telling people that they were at risk of being booted out of Cambridge. They were in 2012, and then, you know, they came back. Anyway, what the rules that had been suggested for them was that any ride would be $50. Any ride. I don't care how long the distance, wherever. And then you couldn't use the phone to engage in the service, which, as you know, is the heart of the thing.
Yeah, tell people what Uber is.
Uber is a service like a taxi, except you hail it, quote unquote, by using GPS technology. So there you are standing on the corner of Guest Street and Market Street. Here we are at WGBH. You whip out your little Uber app. It finds you. They identify the driver, tell you how many minutes he or she will be to pick you up. You have a membership, so you pay the fare before you get in there. So there's no money exchanging and off you go. However, they're not licensed. Why are taxi drivers mad everywhere? Because, as you know, taxi drivers are heavily licensed. They have to be insured, and they have to pay for these medallions, which are very expensive.
Some of them, in the nature of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And after you can't even get $1,000. And just because you want one doesn't mean you can get one. You have to wait in line to get them. So here comes this upstart service, and it is a disruptor, as Christensen would say from the Harvard Business School, saying, hey, we're going to work around that. We're just not using that the regular way that you would hail a taxi. We're going to, or called one. We're going to use this service, and we'll be fine. There have been protests all over the world. London taxi cab drivers protested. Name it. Washington, D.C. There have been big fights. But in D.C. and New York particularly, it's a very well-loved service by many people. And in Cambridge, it was on its way to being very well-loved, and so hence the meeting. And by the way, this meeting did not just focus on Uber, but also something called Lyft, which is a ride-sharing service. Now, that's a little bit different, where you can drive your own car. This is happening a lot on the West Coast, and pick up people. and there's systems and memberships and stuff. It's sort of like Airbnb. We won't get into that. But anyway, so the regulations in the end will come down for both services. What they did at the end of this, you know, very heated discussion was let's take in all of this and let's table it and move forward. And by the way, we're moving away from the $50 charge. Because places like Seattle have settled with Uber and have come up with a compromise deal. So they want to look around at other cities that have worked out deals and figure out if that can happen also in case.
I mean, let me say, first of all, obviously the natural conclusion one all gets to is obviously competition is good for the consumer. It's innovative. And theoretically, this is the hub. And I mean, there's a pun of innovation. Right. But the flip side, there is a flip side to this. The flip side is a lot of these individuals, I'm not so sympathetic to those like those corrupt taxi cab monopolies like we're written about in the Globe.
Boston Cab.
But a lot of these individual cab drivers have spent $750,000 or thereabouts for a medallion. And this cheapens the value to nothing. So what they clearly have to let them in. I mean, it's my hometown.
Excuse me,
I know.
But
they've got to
please.
Reach a compromise, in my opinion, that's sensitive to the consumer.
Why do you
and
think everybody loves Uber? I am very hostile toward I do have empathy for the individual cab drivers, but you get in cabs in Boston for the most part, they're very dirty. The cab drivers do not often know how to get someplace. Mm-hmm. You have to tell them. They don't have a GPS to help them know how to get there. You're driving to the airport. Half the time, they don't even have a Mass Pike thing on, so you're sitting there in line. The service, for the most part, is awful, and they're really expensive. So good for Uber to come in and shake this up. And also, there's politics involved in this, too. It's ridiculous the way they regulate the medallions in Boston to make them so expensive to get.
Well, especially since there's a virtual monopoly, as we learned by the couple of people who are not only, I was going to use the word I'm not supposed to use, can't use, treating the public poorly, but treating their drivers
horribly. Oh, it's terrible the way they treat the drivers.
So I'm on the fence about this because I've had horrible Uber experiences. I've tried them a couple of times here, did not like it. And I never had, my friends all have had good experiences.
What happened?
The one guy, believe it or not, had to figure it out, like where we were going, which annoyed me. And anybody who knows me knows I have no sense of direction. So if I'm directing you, we're in big trouble. So that annoyed me. And then there was some confusion about finding where I live. I didn't like it. And I have taxi drivers that I use all the time that are wonderful. So I've had a different kind of experience. Having said that, I recognize, you know, this is technology and we got to figure out how everybody exists, and certainly how to embrace a technology that is making it better for a lot of other people.
Because, I agree, but there's all I'm saying is got to be compromised. You said you were annoyed by that. You know what I was annoyed by? I was annoyed by a story in the Bay State Banner that I know you wanted to talk about, the headline of which was Blacks, Latinos, Asians cite gains in Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And the basic thrust of this thing is, well, you can tell us the basic thrust, and I'll tell you what annoyed me.
All right. Well, this is a story we're doing on Under the Radar. And the basic thrust is that for the first time, you can see a lot of people of color who are paid staffers in these campaigns, particularly the Democratic campaign for governor. That has not always been the case. And more, they're showing up in communities on a regular basis, not just, you know, a one-time sort of hit and moving through, a drive-by kind of thing. Now, I maintain that that is because of the role modeling of one Elizabeth Warren, who, as I pointed out, was carrying the flag in the Caribbean parade. That woman was everywhere. You know, she made sure she met everybody, was there, was a presence, and followed up and followed up and followed up. And, you know, in a tight race or even in a not tight race, you're talking about communities who, if they know you, will come out and support you. If that's, of course, of any community. But what often happens, and it happened in Martha Coakley's first go round, and it happened with Scott Brown, they just didn't bother to go to those communities or felt they wouldn't have a shot in Scott Brown's case. And that wasn't true. There were some people that wanted to support him and said, please, please come have some people from the community. It didn't happen. Same thing with Martha Coakley. She sort of didn't go there, but she's not making that mistake twice. So this time, you know, people are active. And so I'm appreciative of that because we're now, you know, let's recognize what the population looks like. Let's have some folk from the communities themselves be active.
Okay.
And let's start a pipeline.
Can I say why I'm annoyed by this piece? Why it's fine to celebrate all that, and they do. There's one little tiny paragraph in this story, which I think is the story, which is we're finishing the second and only second term of an African-American governor in the history of the United States of America. There were 14 candidates, by my count. I was at the convention who took the stage to argue for their 15% to get on the ticket. In the wake of Deval Patrick's 8 years, 13 of them were white. One was an Asian American who happens to be a city councilor in Cambridge. And, you know, while it's great that the infrastructure is more populated by people of color now, the fact that other than Leland Chung, there were no people of color candidates. We discussed this the other day. I'm not saying you can win a race because you're not part of the old boys network, you don't have the money. You can run, get signatures, and at least give it a shot. I thought it was a horrible statement, which I think should cause the happiness over the populating of the campaigns and outreach to communities of color to at least be tempered a little bit, because
In the wake of Deval Patrick,
there should have been a greater showing.
I agree with you, but I would have to say that I would have hoped that the governor had a stronger pipeline coming after him.
I agree
too.
With that. I agree with that.
I think there was some work there that could have been done. He's done, obviously, he's made some great appointments all across the state, but, you know, just increasing that pipeline just a little bit would have, you know, made the scenario you're describing change somewhat. So you'll have a situation where you have a guy who is, you know, one of the best political speakers, one, you know, taking himself from corporate to government in a way that I think few could, did an excellent job, and has won twice in circumstances that people thought he couldn't win. And it'll almost be like the hole closes up after he leaves. Like he just goes into.
Exactly. Well, also, the party was run till a few months ago by one of the great organizers who has ever walked the planet, John Walsh. Mm-hmm. John Walsh knows how to pull people together. And the question is, in addition to Deval Patrick, should the party have made greater average? Again, it's good that it's coming up through the ranks. But the reality is, again, in the wake of Patrick, I expected more come Worcester. But I was wrong. In any case, forget Deval Patrick. Let's go back 50 years for a second to something that obviously is, I think, seared in the minds of most, whether they were living or not then. Obviously, Freedom Summer, Mississippi, 50 years ago, registering African Americans to vote in elections where there were virtually none. 50 years. First of all, you're hosting something on Monday night.
Yes, on Monday.
What's that?
One of the screenings of Stanley Nelson's new film called Freedom Summer, which will be airing on PBS Tuesday. But Monday, Stanley and Bob Moses and Dave Dennis, who were both integral parts of Freedom Summer, will be a part of a discussion with me after we show an excerpt from the film. So people who've not seen the film, you know, and that'll be exciting to see the excerpt and then have them there to discuss it. And that'll be at the Strand. Mayor Walsh is going to be there as well. And that's the renovated Strand, you know. It's
all
very exciting. So that should be a wonderful discussion. Expecting come one, come all. That's 6:30 till 8 on Monday.
And by the way, if people recognize the name Bob Moses, Robert Moses, I mean, not only was he central to the Freedom Summer, obviously through the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, but he is still going strong with the Algebra Project in Cambridge, which arguably is one of the most important things in terms of getting poor kids in this country involved and skillful in things like math.
Anna
MacArthur,
genius.
The guy is unbelievable.
Yes, he is. And when you see him in this film, as a young person, you understand how, and just brave. I know that's a word that's thrown around a lot, but to go to Mississippi, it wasn't just that registering people to vote in the South. It was registering people to vote in Mississippi, which Nina Simone had a song about it that I cannot say on the air. That's how bad Mississippi was. Every stereotype that you have about the horrificness of what was happening against civil rights organizers, put it all in Mississippi and then go times 10. That's what they faced. And so we're talking about this nearly 1,000 volunteers, mostly white middle class students, signing up to go to Mississippi in 1964. They finished their training in Ohio, and by the way, the training was to know how to take being spat upon and kicked and punched and all the rest, and to protect themselves for the danger they were likely to get. 1 week after they're there, three of their group go off to check out a church bombing and disappear. And that would be James Chaney and Andy Goodman and Mickey Schwerner. Their bodies were found on August 4th in a shallow grave. I mean, those are the stakes we're talking about. Bob Moses had been there almost alone and then built up a whole system bringing in those students and working with the Corps volunteers. And in fact, James Chaney was a member of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. So you had all of these civil rights organizations coming together to support this movement. And it was a controversial one to invite those white college students down. And the reason was blatant. If the white college students are here, maybe white America will pay attention. So those students had quite an experience. Many of them were quite young. and so are able to talk about their experiences. They came not only from the Northeast. By the way, Barney Frank was one of them.
I didn't know that.
Yes, Barney Frank was a graduate student at Harvard, and he went to Mississippi. And there were kids that came from California and the Midwest. It was an amazing – they lived with black people. It was an amazing summer in many ways.
Don't you have a little story, Jim, about being on a bus?
Well, actually, since you bring it up, 25 years after Freedom Summer, I was president of the Legal Services Union that represent legal services, lawyers, and paralegals around the country. A brilliant lawyer by the name of Lou Myers was a leader of something called North Mississippi Rural Legal Services. Mm. He was being harassed by the Ku Klux Klan. This is 1988 or late 80s, 25 years after Freedom Summer. So I organized our members around the country to go down and support him in a march. And we get down, there were all these tough-talking kids from the North. You know, we're going to take on the forces of evil. We get down there, we march. We go to Jackson, Mississippi, which was the centerpiece of a lot of what happened in the 60s. We march from the legal services office to the police station. As we turn, we're all talking tough. As we turn the corner and see the police station for the first time, it is surrounded by Klan's members holding rifles and bats in the late 1980s at the police station.
Yeah.
So we all quake, probably the most scared I've ever been in my whole life. Yeah. We do our little counter demonstration. Nothing happened. We get back on the school bus to drive from Jackson to Oxford, which is where we were based in Mississippi. They'd cut the brake lines on the school bus. And were it not for the fact that we were driving down a hill where the bus started going like 90 miles an hour, but then thankfully, there was a hill going up at the other end, so we went back and forth and back and forth, finally until we settled at the bottom. We'd probably all be dead. I mean, that little tiny taste of the terror that people had to live through. Forget the people coming from the North, obviously some of whom lost their lives, but people had to live with this every single day. Lou Myers' wife said to us in the late 80s, and then I'll end this part with this, we were talking to her, and she said, not to be melodramatic or to be dramatic at all. I said, how do you deal with this, with a Klan threat? She says, every day I kiss Lou goodbye in the morning. I think that I may never see him again. This is in the late 1980s in Mississippi.
So imagine that 10 times those kids were facing when they were 20 years old there. And the blatantness. And not only the Ku Klux Klan was revived during Freedom Summer, and they were out in force in the way that you've just described, but also the White Citizens Council, the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. These were the businessmen, the political leaders, who, by the way, are in power now out in front. But they were doing the covert reign of terror. So it was pretty horrific, scary situation. And remember, all of them were left with this pall the entire summer, not knowing what had happened with those three and hoping against hope that they were still alive. And of course, they were not. By the way, this was a three-pronged effort. We hear about the voter registration, but there were also the freedom schools, which is really what the white kids were doing, was leading classes in the freedom schools. And the stories that they tell was just wonderful of what they were able to share. And the stories in the film of the little, little black kids who hadn't heard of any of this stuff because of the limited resources they had in those schools and what those students brought to them and how that changed them is an amazing thing. And the last, of course, is the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and the amazing, the wonderful, the brave Fannie Lou Hamer, who was a sharecropper, was almost beaten to death, and in the end faced down Lyndon Baines Johnson as president.
Which is part of the, all the way, the great LBJ thing with Bryan Cranston. So that's what you're doing Monday night. What are you doing Sunday night on the radio?
Well, we talked about one of them. We're going to talk about that story about just the increase in the paid staffers. We're also talking about the movement of the unaccompanied migrant children, and there was a rumor this past week that some of them were being stopped at Hanscom here or being housed at Hanscom. That's not true. I just want to put that to bed.
How about Otis? Was it that true?
Yeah, they were talking about. Yeah, but that's not. Andrea Cabral said, you know, it's routine for us to move detainees through here, but there were no unaccompanied minors. I have a commentary about that on Monday, but you know, so we deal a little bit with that situation. Talk about the slurs being thrown around, homophobic slurs at FIFA, and there's an interesting exchange between my contributors, because one says it's not homophobic, the other one says it is. But anyway, it's been thrown around during the World Cup, so that's a discussion. A lot of other good stuff under the radar.
We'll be listening, and we're going to try to make it Monday too. It sounds like a great program, Kelly. Good to see you.
And the important point Jim, is that Jim did get out of the bus, and we're all very impressed.
Can I tell you something? I am serious.
I'd be under my seat.
I've never been more scared in my whole life.
Well, you should have been.
I'd be under my seat. I would not be getting out of the bus. In any case.
But one last thing. Mississippi Burning, the one feature film that was made by Hollywood years ago, is a lie. Please come to the Strand so that I can tell you the truth. Thank you.
You can catch Kelly Under the Radar Sunday nights, 6 o'clock on GBH, and her weekly commentary is Monday mornings. She's always accessible online at WGBHnews.org. Kelly, thanks as always. Coming up, the legacy of Frederick Law Olmsted and how he changed the way we experience our cities. He's the subject of a new documentary. We talk about it next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, increasingly U.S. companies are moving to the Emerald Isle to enjoy a different kind of green. If you missed it on the radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
Boston, the last 63 years. A flash drive filled with historic and iconic stories. Support WGBH with a gift of $64, and to say thanks, we'll send you one. Details at WGBHnews.org.
Support for WGBH comes from you and the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the Lincoln MKC with the new 2.3-liter EcoBoost powertrain that assists in handling driving situations. More at Lincoln.com. That's Lincoln.com. And Northeastern University, where researchers are engineering new construction materials and methods to build 21st-century sustainable cities. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Hello, I'm John Abbott, president of WGBH. June is a great time to celebrate everything that's good in our community, the strength and power of our city and region, and all that it has to offer. And when you make a gift to WGBH before the first day of summer, we'll make sure to keep you updated on what and who will be coming to town this season, along with plenty of invitations to be our guest at everything, from big summer shows to private tastings with some of the region's best chefs. It's going to be a great summer, made even better by your support. Here's someone to tell you more.
Well, welcome to what we are calling Final Friday here on Boston Public Radio. I'm Kim Saltmarsh, joining Jim and Marjorie today. I'm here to tell you that it really is Final Friday of our June fundraiser. This is the most important fundraiser of the entire year. This is your final chance to support Boston Public Radio with Jim in Marjorie, your final shot at doing that. You know, I'm going to be pretty candid with you. We have a budget gap. We're in a deficit. We have to raise, get this, $70,000 today. We have to do that. We have no choice. And that's because it's the end of our fiscal year, right? So that's when we balance all of the budgets for all of your favorite programs, including this one, Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. We have an hour, 8 minutes to show your support. Look, Jim and Marjorie, you know this. They used to do a show on commercial talk radio, but that station no longer does local conversation. Doing this kind of radio, telling these kind of stories, having these sorts of honest conversations, it's a risky format because it doesn't always fit so neatly into a commercial clock. That's why right now, here on 89.7, Jim and Marjorie's show is listener-supported, supported by you. That means you call the shots, you're in charge, and you say you want more. And now in the 15 months that Jim and Marjorie have been on the air here on listener-supported 89.7, not only is the emphasis on local conversation surviving, it's thriving. Beginning this fall, BPR with Jim and Marjorie will extend to 3 hours every day. So please, please, right now, on your final chance to support Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie, say that things are moving in the right direction. You can do that with a gift in any amount. Hey, if you give $200, we'll send you a free pair of Pat Benatar tickets. We only have 24 pairs. Blue Hills Bank Pavilion. Be there Tuesday, July 1st, 7:30. I can see it now. It's a warm summer night. You, Pat Benatar, your special someone, you want to go, right? 888-897-9424. You can also do your part online, as many people have, at WGBHnews.org. You've got some people to say thanks. thanks to Jim.
I do indeed. Sheila in Winchendon, thank you. I want to anonymously thank an anonymous donor from Acton, Massachusetts. Tricia in Auburn, Mass, thank you. Patricia in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. And Gar in Cambridge contributed at a level that allowed her to get those Pat Benatar tickets. Thanks to all of you. By the way, the number is 888-897-9424. You can go online to WGBHnews.org. I say it every day, and I mean it. If you're a procrastinator anywhere near like what Marjorie and I are, you're going to forget about this despite your best intentions. My advice and my request is you do it now.
You know, a $1,000 gift is not for everybody, but it would be a strong act of personal philanthropy, I should say, because that $1,000 will keep stories coming from Morning Edition on NPR to Frontline on WGBH-TV to everything that goes on here on TV and on the radio. Not for everybody, I said, but I promise you, your gift will benefit everybody who does come to WGBH. So call 888-897-9424 or give online at WGBHnews.org.
Yeah, it's a gift in any amount. If you can swing $1,000, great. If it can be $500, $100, it's whatever works for you. If it's $200, we'll send you those Pat Benatar tickets. But look, at the end of the day, you're supporting great radio and great moments for everybody who listens to it. Look around and ask yourself, is somebody else going to do this? Are you with somebody else? If you can convince them to give, well, more power to you. But most likely, it's Jim, it's Marjorie, it's me, it's you, and it's your only chance to do this. We have an hour, 5 minutes left, and I have to tell you, we still need to hear from 91 people. So we have an hour to hear from 91 people supporting this on Final Friday, your final chance. And hey, don't forget, it's also your final chance to get in on the BPR live in-studio invite list. So you could get a chance, because we're inviting a bunch of people from this list to come in and see a live broadcast of Boston Public Radio, hang out with Jim and Marjorie. They're pretty cool. That could be yours. Final Friday, final chance. We have a huge budget gap to fill, and we need to hear from you right now. 1 hour, 4 minutes, 91 to go at 888-897-9424 and WGBHnews.org.
Thank you, Kim.
Let's talk about something important. You call yourself a public radio listener? Well, how about you call yourself a pledger? Put that coffee down. Coffee is for pledgers only. Oh, have I got your attention now? Only one thing counts in this life, and that is pledging public radio. And if you can't pledge public radio, then goodbye. Hit the bricks, pal, and beat it. Nice guy? Who cares? Successful at your job? I don't give a damn. Good parent? Go home and play with your kids. You want to support public radio? Then pledge. ABP. A always BBP pledging. Always be pledging. Always be pledging. AIDA. Attention, interest, decision, action. Attention. Do I have your attention? Interest. Are you interested? I know you are because you're listening to me right now. Decision. Have you made your decision to pledge? And action. The money's out there. They're waiting for you to pledge it. You don't? I got no sympathy for you. Pick up the phone. Here's the number to call.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. This month, four new parklets have been installed in Boston. They're proving to be a tough sell to city dwellers, urban planners, even newspaper columnist Marjorie, who are using them as a prime example of how the city is wasting money and space. But if Frederick Law Olmsted were still with us, chances are a parklet by his design would receive very favorable reviews.
What is it about an Olmsted landscape that makes people love them so much?
Most folks, when they're walking through the park, they go, wow, this is a really pretty landscape. They have no idea that every nook, every cranny of these landscapes were laid out intentionally.
Olmsted has a double legacy. On the one hand, he's a super pragmatist. He's a problem solver. At the same time, he's a dreamer. What his parks are all about is finding immensely practical solutions to the problem of building a dream in the middle of a city.
That's from the new documentary, Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing America. It airs tonight on PBS. Here with us in Studio 3 is filmmaker Lawrence Hutt, co-owner of Florentine Films, Hutt Productions. Larry, great to meet you, and your piece is spectacular.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, it is spectacular. I was just saying I was embarrassed how much I didn't know before. But there was just a great line from one of the people you interviewed, building a dream in the middle of the city. Before he came along, Olmsted, green space in cities, New York, Boston, Buffalo. What was it like?
Well, those cities were just growing up at the time. And the city fathers were really worried because there was a flood of immigrants. You know, we try like to think of the immigrants coming in the 1880s, 1890s, but they came in decades before that. In Boston, the Irish immigrants were coming in much earlier. And Boston's a great example of where Olmsted really could show his stuff. What he wanted to do was create a release valve, a safety valve for all that energy. And he wanted to also give the people from those immigrant communities, lower class communities, a chance to experience what the upper crust was experiencing. I'll give you a perfect example in New York City. Central Park, which is Olmsted and his partner Vaux are really famous for, they knew that the very wealthy had these great camps up in the Adirondacks. And people would go up there and they party and play for a couple of months before going, you know, on to their next big mansion. And they wanted the people in New York to be able to experience what they had. So in the Upper East Side of Central Park is the Ravine, which looks exactly like the Adirondacks. So with Franklin, years later, Olmsted is asked to create the Emerald Necklace, and he suggests that they build Franklin Park. What he's doing there, he's saying, okay, we have all these tenements, all these triple-deckers, all these thousands of people with no place to go. Let's give them a front yard and a backyard just like the rich people have.
You know, Larry Hott, before we continue on his journey through Central Park, the Emerald Necklace, Niagara Falls, which I had no idea he had a hand in.
Me neither.
The U.S. Capitol, Yosemite, the list is endless. Let's go back to the earlier phase of his life. Marjorie said as you walked in the studio, boy, was I embarrassed by what I didn't know. Multiply that by 9. Here he is from a piece he wrote in the New York Times. This is Olmsted himself. He reported extensively on slavery for the New York Times from the South. Here's an excerpt from one of his observations.
January 26, 1854. Southerners often represent the condition of their slaves to be so happy and desirable. We might wonder that they do not sometimes take measures to be made slaves themselves, or at least occasionally offer their children for sale to the highest bidder. The sale and purchase of men, women, and children is such an insult to the human race that nothing else more demands the shame and the indignant protest of all men.
Well, a beautiful writer as well. You know, the sense you get from this, then he went on to found the precursor to the Red Cross before he starts his career in the areas that we all know. You get the sense from your documentary that he almost fell into all these things. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but what journalism background did he get before he wrote these eloquent passages from the South pre-Civil War?
Let me tell you something funny about Olmsted. A friend of mine said that he takes great heart from Olmsted because this friend has a 28-year-old son who hasn't discovered himself yet. And Olmsted doesn't know what he's going to do with his life until he's 42 years old. And everything he does before that time, he screws up.
Yeah.
You know, he wants
I
to,
love that.
He wants to be a sailor, so he goes to China, but he gets scurvy. You know, and he has to be carried off the boat. He tries to be a farmer, and the farm goes belly up twice, right? He's the surveyor, and it doesn't work out. He's a clerk, and he hates it. But he's a good writer. And when he goes to England, basically taking time off from his farm that's not working out, he comes back and he writes this beautiful book about it. And he ends up meeting the Transcendentalists and getting involved with publishers. And eventually, he is asked by the brand new New York Times to be their first foreign correspondent, except the foreign country is the South. And he goes down to the South as a reluctant abolitionist. He really doesn't think the slaves are ready yet for freedom.
He said he was going to have an open mind about slavery, one of the reasons he got hired, right?
Yeah, and then what happens after 2 years of writing about it and realizing that the system is sick and that farmers who don't own slaves, who actually hire people, do better. He's so angry about this that he starts shipping howitzers out to the Free Kansas movement, and he gets a guerrilla manual from Europe, and he underlines it and says, this is what you need to do to fight.
So how did he fall into Central Park?
Well, he's doing so poorly in life. he has so little money that he goes to his friends. He's asking for work, and one of the friends says to him, well, I have connections with these Central Park Commission, which had set aside land in the middle of New York City, knowing that they better set it aside before it gets consumed by the grid that was, you know, building right up from the lower Manhattan. And they said, well, we need somebody who understands drainage. Yeah, I think about Olmsted. He's so famous now. But what he was known for was that he had been a farmer and he understood drainage and he had these connections. So they hire him to be the superintendent to clear the land. They get rid of the people who were living there. They get rid of all the brush. And there were these rendering factories. And the place stank. And while he's doing that, this other man named Calvert Vaux, who's this 4'11" British architect who had been brought over to America by a guy named Andrew Jackson Downing. Oh, this guy Downing was a brilliant designer, would have been the Olmsted, but he gets killed in a steamboat accident, a steamboat race on the Hudson. And this guy Vaux says, I want to compete. And there was a design competition for Central Park. And he said, I want to compete, but I don't know the lay of the land, but I can draw. So he goes, he meets Olmsted and says, would you partner with me? And Olmsted says, okay, you know, I'm just the superintendent, but sure, I'll help you draw up the plans. And they submit at the last minute, 11:59, the night of the deadline for the submissions.
So Olmsted was not a trained landscape architect. He didn't go to school to study all this.
He knew nothing about it. He had surveying background.
Uh-huh.
He had farming background.
And he knew drainage, Larry. He knew drainage.
So the beauty you talk about in your fantastic documentary with people stopping with their cameras and saying, look at this vista, look at that vista. Was that Vaux? Or, how do you pronounce it?
Vaux.
Or was that Olmsted?
Well, that's a good question of who did what. It's like Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned that the vistas. One of my favorite parts in the film is when somebody says, people think they're taking a great picture in an Olmsted park, but really Olmsted set it up for them. So wherever you turn, one of the hardest things we had to do in this film was not let Central Park dominate it.
Well, you didn't.
Thank you. And you know, there's the Buffalo Park system. And then, of course, the jewel is the Emerald Necklace.
When he moves from New York to Brookline, which I was not aware of either. And then the 7-mile stretch.
Why does he move to Austin from New York? Because he's had it with New York. Because he's been fired for the last time by the Central Park commissioners. In other words, he's been fired many times. He's had fights with them. He wanted to plan the Bronx. In New York, and they wouldn't let him do it.
That's too bad.
Yeah, it would have helped.
It would have been very different.
So he comes up here. He's invited up here by his friend Richardson, the great architect. And when you look around the Emerald Necklace and see those beautiful bridges and how they're integrated into the design, it was a wonderful, wonderful partnership.
You know, Larry, I want to differ with you on something. You're the expert on this, but I'm going to tell you you're wrong. When you did a Lennon and McCartney comparison, Marjorie and I are saying this morning, Vaux and Olmsted. Why is it that neither of us had never heard the name Calvert Vaux? And from your documentary, it's clear that it's not quite 50-50, but it's pretty close. Why has he escaped, Vaux? Why is he such an unknown to most of us?
There's a lot of good reasons. It's a good story. Vaux was brilliant, but he was a fumfer. He was unable to speak clearly. He was very small and very nervous, and he didn't write well.
Uh-huh.
Olmsted, who was 5'6", he wasn't a giant, but he was a good writer, and he was prolific, and he expressed himself well. He was the front man. So he can go out into the community, and he would meet with the city fathers, and he would convince them to do something. Vaux didn't have any of the gift of gab. So we know Olmsted, first of all, because everybody knew his name, and second, because he wrote so much. I'll give you an idea how much he wrote. The table of contents of his writings at the Library of Congress, the table of contents is 300 pages.
Wow. Wow. So tell us about Niagara Falls. This was news to me. Tell us what Olmsted did with Niagara Falls.
You know, that's where I first came across Olmsted. I've done two films on Niagara Falls, and the big part of Niagara Falls is the preservation of the falls. You could not see the falls without paying in the 1850s, 60s, 70s. And it was also full of these mills and processing plants, and it was very polluted. And people would come, and they would be angry and disgusted because it had a reputation for centuries as the wilderness symbol of America. So Olmsted's brought there by the city fathers of Buffalo, where he'd been doing a park system, and they said, can you do something? And Olmsted starts a 10-year campaign. He hires public relations consultants. He even hires a minister to go around campaigning. And the result is that the New York legislature passes a bill to create the Niagara Falls Reservation. It's the first time that land is set aside to be preserved. And then he designs the work, and he brings back his old partner, Vaux, to work with him. And they design Goat Island, which is where the bulk of the New York Niagara Reservation is. Well, this is extremely important because now we've set a precedent for preservation. And the New York legislature puts in the Constitution the Forever Wild Clause, which creates the Adirondacks. And then a few years later, after Olmsted's dead, his son becomes the major consultant to the Park Service, writes the rationale for preservation, and that leads over another 50 years to the Wilderness Act, which allows us to set aside not just parks, but whole vast tracts of land as wilderness. So you can trace a direct line, it's almost like a relay race from Olmsted to all the other preservationists, John Muir, right up through Bob Marshall, right up to the Wilderness Act.
That's the voice of Larry Hott. Larry's terrific documentary, Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing America, airs tonight on PBS. What's the guiding philosophy? One of the things I took away from your film, which I thought was great, is there's no cookie cutterism in any of this thing. And my sense is, other than the brilliance of the work, if I showed you a park and you didn't know there was Olmsted, you wouldn't know other than the fact that it was through everything fit what. So what was the common thread, if there was one, through all of this guy's work?
You know, one of the hardest things for us to figure out making the film was, what does the phrase Olmstedian means? When people said, that's Olmstedian. You know, and there's a couple of answers. One is, there are certain elements that you see in a lot of Olmsted parks. And one of them are the winding, curvilinear pathways. He also designed a lot of suburbs. And he's the one who invented that garden suburb with that doesn't have those rectilinear streets, but that has that curve and those cul-de-sacs and those islands. That's Olmsted. You can see that reflected in the parks as well. He's also full of surprises. You see this in Franklin Park, where you come under an archway and you see a hint of what you're going to see. Maybe there's some bright sunlight on a patch of grass, and you come in and it opens up to this huge field.
That's true.
And then you go through, and it goes into a little copse and then a little stream. What's great about Olmsted, though, is that most of the time, all of that is engineered. Once in a while, he'll take a piece of land, and his guiding principle was, if it's perfect, leave it alone. But if it doesn't look the way I want it to look, let me make it perfect.
Yeah.
So most of the parks are completely engineered. And in Boston, you really see this. When he does the Back Bay Fens,
yes,
that's actually one of the first environmental reclamation projects in the world. It was a salt marsh, and it was a sewage disposal area. And he was asked to fix it. And he designs it in such a way that it looks beautiful like a park, but it actually still functions as a place to clean the water. And then he's asked to take the muddy river and turn it into a park, and that's why we have the Riverway. But look at it. It's all engineered and designed. And one of the great things he did, and you can see this in the bonus videos on the PBS website, is he uses photography to document it. So he takes pictures of when he starts a project, and then people come back later, long after he's dead, and they show what it looked like. He had to have infinite patience. As he says, a landscape architect has to have this vision 40 years into the future. It's almost like being an independent filmmaker.
So what was his deal?
Right.
I mean, I think the words used in the documentary were he was creating not a park in a city, but a city in a park was the goal. What was the bottom line that united all these things? That this was the place where people should gather? And what was the concept?
It's almost a religious ideal because he believes in community above all. And I think about Olmsted not as a landscape architect, but as an urban planner. And I think landscape architects do wonderful work, but they are connected to urban planning. In fact, his son, Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., founds the Landscape Architecture School at Harvard, which then eventually adds on the urban planning school, because Olmsted is thinking of city design. He's thinking about how people relate to each other. But Olmsted, remember we talked about Olmsted and going down south. Olmsted is at heart a reformer. And he thinks that parks can change people, and contact with nature can change people. And it's idealistic. But I think in a way, he's right. Just think about how you feel when you
he's
get
right.
outside
yeah.
of the city. And he didn't want people to have to travel miles and miles. He didn't think, it was back to his feeling of that you didn't have to have money to feel the meditative aspects, the curative aspects of nature. You can do that in the city. So he wants to put, actually, when he builds a whole park system, he wants to put the city in the park. He wants the whole place to feel like a park. And Buffalo is a wonderful example because there He started with three parks. There are now 18 parks, and they're connected by parkways. And those parkways are themselves parks. And when you walk out the front door of many streets in Buffalo, you're walking into a park, which you can then walk on for a couple of miles and get to another park. And then you exit it, find another parkway, and get to another park. And that idea is that we don't want to have a regimented, built-up environment. We want to think through what's going to happen to this city. In fact, he would go outside cities and say to the city park commissioners, buy the land when it's cheap, build a park, the property values of the houses that are built around the park will pay the taxes that will pay for the maintenance. Unfortunately, he didn't predict just how expensive the parks would be, which is why we have Park Conservancy. The Enrail Park Conservancy in Boston is a good example. They have to be public-private partnerships, otherwise these parks will fail.
But, you know, I happened to be on Sunday on the walking along the Jamaica Way and going out to the Arboretum, and he's absolutely right about that vision. You have people out there, rich people, poor people, regular people, having picnics, and it's magical. You're enclosed in trees, and you walk through those pathways, and he was absolutely right. It's a magical place.
You know, one of the most dangerous things about filming a film about Olmsted and the parks is that you can point the camera anywhere, and there's no end to the people watching. So Jamaica Pond is amazing. Yeah. What's going on there. And we didn't, parts of the music, you know, the film, we didn't really need a music track because there's so much music going on in the background.
Well, it's a beautiful film.
It's a beautiful film.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us. You are co-owner of the Florentine Films Hot Productions, and the film is Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing America. You can catch it tonight, June 20th. That's Friday, PBS. Check your local listings. Larry, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations for a beautiful, piece of work.
Thank you so much, Larry, for having me.
Up next, it's time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney and her famous, fabulous list of obsessions and observations. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
America's most divisive political issue, a surprising coming-of-age story.
It's not really about pro-choice or anti-choice. This is actually just one woman's story.
The film Obvious Child, anything but obvious, very funny, and a profound story for our time. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, committed to providing patients with quality cancer care, innovative services, and personalized treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer. And American Experience, inviting you to a free preview of Freedom Summer, the latest civil rights story from Stanley Nelson, Monday, June 23rd at Dorchester Strand Theater, presented by WGBH and the City of Boston, wgbh.org/events.
By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled, here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world.
Boston, the last 63 years, a collection of iconic stories and moments from the last six decades, all on a WGBH flash drive.
90% of every ballpark in the world is a kind of peculiar folk history.
Attorney General Riley said to me, "You're the governor, keep the election, and if anybody goes to court, I'll defend you."
This is our city, and its future is in our hands. She said, "I think I'll go
to Boston." Reserve yours today. And thanks.
You heard it there. This is our city. This is New England. This is your station, your home for public radio. Good afternoon. I'm Kim Saltmarsh. I'm joining Jim Marjorie and Jim and Marjorie. Now you've become one person, Jim Marjorie. So look, this is what you're supporting, by the way. This is Final Friday, if you haven't heard. Your final chance to support Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. You have 43 minutes, my friend. Your final chance to be invited, by the way, to sit in with Jim and Marjorie during Boston Public Radio. Anybody who gives in the next 43 minutes is going to be on our invite list. We're selecting a few people this summer. I hope that you're next. It's such a fun show to watch. Jim will behave himself, I swear. So you could be there. Your final chance to get in on the BPR ticket deal of the day. Pat Benatar tickets, Marjorie, $200.
Yeah, I mean, how much fun would that be to go
see
Pat Benatar at the Blue Hills Bank Pavilion Boston, Tuesday night, July 1st, 7:30 p.m. I mean, she's a fantastic star. She still sounds great. Here's the deal. Support WGBH with a gift of $200, and we will say thank you with a free pair of tickets to see Pat Benatar.
Well, hi, I'm Jim Marjorie. And in any case, I want to thank Barbara in Orlando, Florida. Thank you, Barbara. An anonymous donor in Arlington, Mass., Robert in Boston, Peter in Tiverton, Rhode Island, Don in Chestnut Hill. The number is 888-897-9424, or you can go online. It's actually quite simple, wgbhnews.org. The last thing I'll say is, do it now. I've told you a million times, nobody procrastinates more than Marjorie and I do. If you're of the same ilk, do it now. Please, as a favor to us and yourself.
Please do it now. I mean, look, we've got a lot of fun incentives. Pat Benatar, we've got that flash drive you just heard about. 63 years of amazing, incredible stories. You did that. You're still doing that with a support in any amount. A gift in any amount will do it. Look, I've been candid with you. We are at a deficit. We have to raise $70,000 today. We cannot do it. We will not do it without you. If you rely on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie, if it entertains you during the day, think about just how much that's worth to you. Maybe 500, maybe 1,000, maybe it's 3,000. It's whatever works for you. Let's rally. New England is rallying today. Let's cut this budget gap down at 888-897-9424 or online at wgbhnews.org. You have 41 minutes.
Listening to Jim and Marjorie at lunchtime is kind of like having a lunch date with my well-informed aunt and uncle, and I realized that I needed to start contributing to our lunch date by becoming a sustaining member. Hi, my name's Amanda from Dorchester, Massachusetts, and I'm a sustainer for WGBH because I think it's important to be an engaged member of my community. And it really just takes a couple of minutes to figure out how you can best give for the coming year, and you get to pick a gift, which is also really exciting, and it's a way to advertise that I'm an active member of the WGBH community and be part of the community that's giving back to the radio station that gives me so much.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When she isn't on TV covering and analyzing the news or doing her pro bono work, obviously, as the Commissioner of Common Sense, Emily Rooney joins us. If you missed last week, if Marty Walsh is here Friday, we're going to play some of that for her. Emily Rooney joins us for open mic and her famous list. Hey there, Emily.
Hey, Jim and Marge. How are you guys?
We're
beautiful
very,
Friday.
We're very well. So this Olympic thing.
Be a good day for the Olympics, wouldn't it?
It would be a great
it
day.
It would, actually.
It would be a great day for the Olympics. But I read Shirley Young's column this morning. She's got venues. We're going to have beach volleyball in Franklin Park, and we're going to have beach
Boston
volleyball
Common.
In Boston Common.
Taekwondo right around the corner from us.
And dressage in Franklin Park. I mean, we should get everything all figured out here.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You guys were poo-pooing this. You guys were big naysayers. We talked about this last week.
Yeah.
Jim, don't look at me that way, Jim. You were the biggest naysayer. I said it could be very exciting.
I still
feel that way about it.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to all rent out our apartments anyway, right?
Think about that. You can make a ton of money.
Yeah,
what would the Ritz-Carlton dowagers think looking across the street at the little bikini-clad beach ball
Don't
volleyball
Don't you love that,
players?
The idea of beach ball volley on the Boston Common?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, let me just say, it is
Jim
rare,
went last time
it
around.
Is rare that I am open-minded about anything.
I know that.
But I know you know that. That's why I'm saying it. But I have to say, while I have my deep concerns, the prospect is exciting. It was a great line. Did you see that David D'Alessandro, used to run Hancock, is quoted in this piece by Shirley Leung this morning. I'm going to paraphrase it. He says, hey, if Atlanta could do it, Atlanta's a second-class city at best.
Exactly.
In 1996.
And he was the big supporter of the Utah Olympics, the Salt Lake City Olympics with Mitt Romney. I mean, John Hancock was the number one sponsor of that event. So he knows a lot about Olympics. He knows what it takes for, a second-class city to pull off something like that. And you got to argue with Salt Lake City, other than vast tracks of terrain, it's not exactly a world-class city.
Well, so you get the sense. We asked Brian McGorry about this the other day, editor of the Globe. He said something like, take a deep breath and just, consider the potential positives. I asked Marty Walsh last week on television a couple of weeks ago. He said he's got an open mind. My sense is, little by little, this is sort of percolating up.
The thing Gannis Arena could handle the pool, by the way.
You know what I didn't know?
That pool is huge.
Did you know till this morning that while the International Olympic Committee will not make a decision between international sites and whatever the U.S. Site is till 2017, that as early as January, Shirley Young writes, they're going
to
pick the U.S.
You've got to have 10 to 12 years lead time. In other words, to pull it off, there's no other way.
And you know what I was saying to Jim this morning, too? This is obviously a college town. The colleges are pretty much emptied out in the summertime.
So they put people in those dorms?
Well,
is that what they do?
Well, they could.
Well,
they certainly could.
Yeah.
They're talking about the Bayside Expo Center, which has been shut down, opened as a place to house some of the athletes, and then it would become dorms for UMass Boston. So,
well, they mean building new.
They got to build an Olympic Village, but like some of the dorms could be for media and visitors, and who knows?
How do you think Bob Kraft, who's supporting this, feels? He wanted to build in South Boston. He was obviously stopped, and now they're talking. Stopping it was a mistake.
Of course it was.
How would it be to have it in downtown Boston? It'd be fabulous.
Yeah,
but how do you think he's going to feel if we end up building a 60 or 80,000 seat Olympic stadium in South Boston?
And then what will it be used for after that?
Well, that's the interesting. They said concerts, that sort of thing. No. That is where I think at least
Bob would move the team. Why not?
I don't know.
That whole Patriots.
Well, he owns the stadium though out there. They personally own the stadium.
That's the one thing I worry about is all these big structures then being empty like a ghost town with Olympics.
Well, I worry about the cost. I mean, and by the way, we have John Fish here with us on the radio on Monday, who's the chair of the committee that is championing this thing. He's from Suffolk Construction. I think the threshold issue is going to be, is there an ironclad guarantee of no taxpayer dollars involved in this, even if there's an overrun? I think if they can convince the public that that's the case, we have gridlock all the time anyway, so who cares about it for a few weeks? What kind of great soap opera would we have for 10 years leading up to the Olympics?
It would
Olympics?
Be wonderful. It really would. Come on, it's a great news story. Think of all the corruption.
That's right. That's right. Big dig, too.
We
can have another story about the people hauling mounds of dirt from one place to another, bringing them back, and
won't get
making
any
enough to buy second homes in Florida.
Okay, so speaking of corruption, let's talk casinos for a couple of minutes.
I love it.
Charlie Baker was with us yesterday, one of the Republicans running for governor. We asked him about getting the casino question on the ballot because, as you know, the Supreme Judicial Court is apparently going to rule any day.
I want to see it on the ballot. When it gets on the ballot, we can have the conversation about what my position is and why, okay? My first position is I think the Attorney General is wrong. I think this question belongs on the ballot. I think the voters have a right to make the call.
And again, we will know any day if the voters will be able to make
call. I have to disagree with Charlie Baker. I don't think it should be on the ballot. And we have a track record of this. As soon as you put something to the voters, you know, they wouldn't approve it. And you know, they wouldn't have approved gay marriage 10 years ago. So you don't want – this has gone through a legal process. Legislature has approved it. It shouldn't go to the people, even though, as we've pointed out today, there's a waning support. Actually, about 52% want to keep the law. 41% want to repeal it.
In the Globe poll, which is dramatically different from the Herald poll about a week ago by David Paleologos from Suffolk, where 47% said no and only 37%
said – Did you see that thing, by the way, in the Wall Street Journal today? They did a complete analysis of all the casinos all throughout New England.
No.
Back in the 60s, there were four. Now there are 24 casinos, not counting the ones they're about to build in Massachusetts. And – They did this graph showing the support of these things and who's going and the fact that they're all going under. And he says it's not sustainable. I mean,
you know who said that, by the way? Somebody who knows a lot more than we do. The guy from Dorchester, who's now a billionaire in Las Vegas, that withdrew from this. What's his name? The guy who, big-time Republican, gave $20 million.
Shelley
Adelson.
Shelley Adelson.
The reason he said, I'm not going to get involved in this, is too much.
Yeah,
you can't sustain three casinos.
Yeah.
Well, you know, interesting part of this poll, it's in the Globe today. The most interesting part to me was 29% of Massachusetts residents said they visited a casino 2 years ago, obviously in another state. Only 33% said they would visit a casino in Massachusetts,
no
meaning that that's a limited piece of the population that's not going to grow realistically.
No one's going.
So
you'll go once.
Can I challenge also your notion the legislature gave this
a fair
Democratic – I've said this to you before. I did the math on this. 68 legislators, 68 members of the House – who voted against this when their boss was Sal DeMasi, because he was against it as Speaker, flipped their vote. They had an epiphany, and 68 of them who had voted no 2 years earlier voted yes because Bob DeLeo,
that's
the Speaker,
the way it always
was. I understand, but that's not democracy.
Right, well,
I mean, so the
nothing that the legislature does, or which legislature is so warped, you know, to one side anyway. I mean, there's
my view is absolutely
procedure.
give it to the public, and if it turns out that after what is going to be a debate,
I'm fine with that. By the way, it's great. It's a better story. Well, I mean, I don't think they should, but I'm fine with it just in terms of, you know, giving us more fodder.
Yeah.
Also, it could be the centerpiece, depending on where Charlie Baker goes, and he wouldn't answer the question for us yesterday.
No.
Depending on where he goes, it could also be the central issue in the race between Charlie Baker, assuming he's the nominee.
Yeah.
We don't know if Mark Fisher is going to do, and the Democrat. Let's move on to another local story that I think has captivated a lot of people. Most people, if they don't live in South Boston, are pretty excited. The Whitey movie, yeah. Johnny Depp, Benedict Cumberbatch from Sherlock Holmes fame. What's your take on the story in the Globe today?
I thought people in South Boston being upset.
The
Globe story missed it a little bit because apparently people are concerned that the movie is going to portray Whitey Bulger in some kind of a heroic light, you know, that he was the savior of South Boston, that he kept drugs out and all of that. But first of all, I don't think anybody really knows what the plot line is because, as you read in the paper today, one of the scenes that they taped, the film yesterday, was the strangulation of
Deborah Hussey
in somebody's basement, which apparently was really grim and
not
dramatic.
Heroic.
But I think the bigger issue is about the money. I mean, this is a movie. Obviously, it's going to be big around here, but I think it'll catch the attention nationwide, worldwide, because it's that whole underworld, underbelly kind of story, and it goes back to the 50s, 60s, 70s, so it's got all the cool cars and everything. the fact that they're going to make so much money off it, and these victims, many of them have not received a thing. I mean, not that the movie industry owes anything to the victims, but it's kind of like there's a warped aspect.
Yeah, I had never thought of it until you said it to us in the newsroom this morning. I think you were totally right.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting if they make $100 million, they should give $100 million to the victims. But the fact that they have not made a statement, at least none of us have heard it, saying a piece of this, 10%,
something,
is going to go to the families of those people who lost somebody they loved,
yeah, 19
the most brutal
people.
Serial killer in Boston history, is rather unbelievable.
It's unseemly,
actually.
In a way. Yeah.
Well, especially since I assume Johnny Depp, who I happen to be a fan, making $20 million for the movie?
Easily.
So it isn't like they can't afford to throw a little cash in the direction of people who really suffered.
It's just another Hollywood production to virtually everyone, Scott Cooper, the director, everybody else. But it's something that we lived so personally in the last year and a half, not to mention the 5 decades before that, but during the trial and rehashing that and rehearing all of the horrific crimes.
Well, especially since the government corruption prevented people like the Donahues from getting their day in court and their just recompense for this disaster.
Yeah, the fact
when
that the FBI was complicit in all of this. It's really...
Can I tell you, when the families came out, like the Donahues, some of them, I hope I got the family right, when the families would come outside the Moakley courthouse and say things like, the question is, are you satisfied with the progress of the trial? Yeah, I'm satisfied with one exception, the wrong people are in the defendant's dock, meaning the FBI should be sitting
Debbie
there
Davis's
next to Whitey Bulger. Right, of course,
too.
Steve Davis. Right.
And Patricia Donahue, a blonde-haired woman, and she had her son, Tommy. Yeah. I think that was his name. I love the end of the story, though, because I was talking to my colleague, Peter Galsunas, of course, who lives in South Boston, lived there all his life, and I didn't even know the story was coming out in the paper today, and he was saying, oh, it's a mess over here. I said, what's going on? He said, the whole thing is all south is shut down because of this damn movie. There's no place to park. The traffic is all
backed up. They've been everywhere. Copley Square, they shut it down.
That's what they're really complaining about over there in South Boston.
I know.
But you
have to
say,
we loved it in East Cambridge. We really did.
But they shouldn't complain in South Boston.
Yeah, because
you know
they don't get all the parades that we get, Marjorie.
Not just that.
Right?
You know, in South Boston, it's a pretty good bet that you can double park, sometimes even triple park, for a couple of hours before you get a ticket.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. Can't do it in the Back Bay.
They're wired over
there.
Some
of your finest journalism, Marjorie, has been about triple parking in South Boston.
I have done extensive investigative work. Yes,
okay, and now for the Whitey Bulger movie. Here's why you're here, at least why we're here, is for this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter.
I have absolutely no interest.
No, she doesn't, but we do. Now, here's what I have to say every time. This is Emily's List, and I have to say, because it's part of the thing, Emily, is it thematic today? Is there a theme to the list?
I'm going to start by telling you how I started on this, but I'm working on a really good one for a couple weeks out that you guys are going to love. I'm just saying. I wish I could tell you what it was so you could add to it. But so here's how I got going on Emily's List today.
Yes.
I was calling a place to make a reservation for dinner for a group and not thinking what day it was. And the guy says to me, oh, you want to come to the Father's Day barbecue? And I said, no. And I'm thinking, I can't think of anything more repulsive than barbecue. You know, this meat slathering on a gas stove with all this fake barbecue sauce with a phony, smoky taste. And so that got me to thinking about foods I really don't like.
Oh, good. This could be good.
This could be good.
All right. So I'm sure everybody has them. And it's almost like neurotic. You know, once it's on your don't eat them list, that's it.
I agree with that so far.
Yeah. So barbecue is really right at the top of my list.
Love barbecue.
I mean, I love to cook. I like to put things on the grill, but that slathering, forget it. Disgusting.
Okay, fine.
All right.
Jeez.
All right. I like virtually every kind of melon except watermelon. I can't stand the taste.
Too
can't
watery
stand,
for you?
Can't stand the consistency.
Yeah, consistency
don't like well. The seat. Don't like anything about. Don't even like the smell.
Also, you know, when you cut it,
correct.
It goes bad really quickly.
Oh,
it goes
mushy.
It's too soft.
It's an inferior melon. I agree with you there, Emily.
Oh, good.
Write that down, Margaret.
All right,
write it down.
Now this is one that's always controversial because you either love them or hate them.
It's really controversial.
Artichokes. I can't stand them. Not even as a vessel for butter.
Them.
And I love butter
because they're hard to eat.
Them.
I mean, is that what your problem is?
Oh, wait, I don't understand it.
When you go to California and you take them off one at a time and you dip them in the sauce.
Like,
you
like the sauce
slide,
of the butter. I mean, I don't understand it. I don't understand the whole thing. And I'm a decent cook. I've tried them. I don't like them pickled or whatever that.
Oh,
thing.
I love those.
Jim, how do you feel about artichokes?
I have to say, and I hate to be right in the middle here, I can take them or leave them. You know, that's what it is. I'm
sort
of halfway
really
between
soft
the two.
And that, when the container and the glass, and they're really soft. Oh, the chicken, they're great.
Awful. All right.
Good.
So here's one that I really like the look of. And so I'll buy it and throw it into stir fry and all that, but then I pick them out. Green or red peppers? I find them overbearing. I like the way they look, you know, beautiful.
You mean
stir-fry.
As in hot, are you talking?
No, I love, actually, I like the hot ones better, but just the big, you know, the big
green
or red.
Oh, I don't like, I'm not crazy about them. I mean, I could, again, take them and leave them. The spicy ones, the hot ones, though.
The jalapenos,
are
I
as
like
good.
Those.
And also the red peppers. I don't know what the names of them
those.
All are. They are fabulous.
No green. No green. Love
By the
red.
Way, there's nothing I enjoy more, I'm serious, than having tears come down my eyes.
No, I like
eyes.
That, too.
Oh,
I
love
that.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
How do you feel about pimento? Disgusting.
Can I tell you what one of my favorite, one of my
I've
most famous appetizers is for a group kind of thing?
Antipasto.
Is you make egg salad on a little, whatever they're called, little toast kind. What are those toast things called? They're like
Melba
crackers.
Toast.
Melba toast with a pimento on top. It doesn't do it for you?
No.
Forget that.
I don't,
okay,
once again, it's all about consistency for me. They're
slimy.
Soggy
I know.
And,
fine. Okay.
Right. So going on with that,
these
three I'm going to lump all together that I just
please
will not eat. Yogurt. Custard or flan?
Oh, man.
Oh, my
flan
God.
Flan is so good.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
Custard is probably
can't
one
stand
of my
the
favorite things.
See this baby right here, this yogurt with peach in it? Oh, my goodness.
No. Flan, you go out and have it. What's the name for flan at the restaurants?
Flan.
Creme brulee. Creme brulee.
No,
but
that's
creme brulee
different.
When they crisp the
that's
top.
Different.
That is a whole. Is that what they do?
When they crisp the top. Creme brulee is different than flan.
That's a total consistency thing.
Flan is like a cake and it has like a gooey sauce.
Okay. Do you like chocolate pudding? Tapioca pudding?
No,
well,
no pudding,
when
no
the film forms on the
How
top,
about bread
you got a
pudding?
Problem.
No.
Oh,
I
okay,
just am giving you categories. Yogurt,
here.
Custard, flan. Forget it.
Okay.
All right. I love all kinds of pasta except gnocchi.
Yeah.
Gross.
Well,
we
this
potato
in the middle thing, that's not. It's not much.
Yeah, it's kind
there,
of an overdue, isn't it? Overkill.
It's just
with the pasta and
okay,
the
potato.
Okay,
we agree. Move on.
Well, it
I
is
mean,
potato.
It's fine. We're fine with it.
All right. I like everything salty except caviar.
Oh, man, I love caviar.
No.
I love
too salty.
Caviar.
And fishy.
Fishy, hate
What's
it.
The name of that joint
hate
in Harvard
it.
Square that sells? Doesn't sell it anymore. You'd buy that special thing during the holiday. What's the name of that famous?
Cardulo's.
Not Cardoon's.
That's
all right.
Marjorie, go ahead.
Duck.
Love duck.
It's too gamey, no matter how it's cooked. People say, you'd have it cooked properly. It's like,
exactly.
No. It's
okay,
awful.
Horrible.
You're a little angry
any
about
kind
these
of dumpling.
Foods, Emily. I mean, just
you don't, like
you don't have to eat them. Don't
any
eat them.
Any kind of dumpling.
Oh,
matzo ball.
Oh.
Even those Chinese. No.
Okay,
no dumplings.
Oh.
All right. In the
King
junk food category.
Like an ethnic slur also on the list.
In the
go
junk
ahead.
Food category. And
go
I like ahead. I like Fritos.
You
and
mentioned
I like
oysters. Where are you on oysters?
Oh, I have that here. I'm getting to
I'm
that.
Sorry.
Yeah, the weekend's starting like in an hour. Okay, go ahead.
Junk food.
Yeah, no, what is it?
I don't like Raisinets, candy corn, Twizzlers, or Pirate's Booty.
Nobody likes candy corn. I mean, there's never any. The only fun of candy corn is you can slip it up on one of
You'd
your
be
teeth
surprised.
And smile at your friends.
And that licorice and all that. All right,
okay,
in the drinks category, I don't like
okay,
iced tea.
Okay, so Edgar, we're told, likes candy corn.
I don't
fine.
Like iced tea, iced coffee, rum, or Riesling wines.
Okay.
Getting bored?
Rum
God.
Is fabulous. Rum
and
drinks
so
in
Riesling.
Summer are as good as
oh,
it
no.
gets.
That's like drinking syrup.
Why don't you ask me what I don't like in food?
What do you like?
The only thing I will not eat, is cold goat cheese. What do you think of that?
Cold goat
cheese?
Oh, I love cold
Hot
goat cheese.
Hot goat cheese is
I like
fabulous.
Them both.
Oh, like, okay, go
All right,
ahead. I
recently, you asked about oysters. I've
what
recently
about?
Acquired an
so
taste.
So have I. So have I.
And recently
Late in life.
Acquired a taste for martinis. I'd never had a martini
Martin's
in my life.
A big martini
martinis.
Drinker.
Martinis.
Vodka
That's or gin.
Is that it?
Vodka or gin.
Oh, I drink gin.
You know, something it's very difficult to find a good martini. Most people do not
Four
do
seasons.
A good job. Four Seasons has great martinis. The little slivers of ice cream.
Oh, that's the
time.
Best.
Yeah, yeah.
They look so beautiful, too.
Oh, my God. Really cold.
Okay, that was an excellent list. Now, what are you doing tonight on Beat the Press?
Well, let's see. We're doing a bunch of things. We're doing this kind of neoconservative lift, you know, that the renewed war in Iraq is giving people like Dick Cheney and
Paul Wolfowitz is like on CNN 24/7. Yeah.
So, and I have a really funny piece on, you know, Dr. Oz. He was taken to the
woods. Yes.
And he's actually sticking by his claims that all these miracle diet pills and all this work. He's not backing off. Congress really gave him a whack, Claire McCaskill.
Good. You know what? One thing about Dr. Oz, he hates flan. You know that? He does. He's said it many a time in front of Congress.
Tune in at 7. We've got more.
We love it. Okay. Emily Rooney.
Emily Rooney, tonight at 7 on Beat the Press, every night at 7 in Greater Boston. Emily, that was a fantastic
list.
It was actually quite good. Yes,
up next is our Friday News Quiz, a special listener turn contestant edition.
I love
That's
this.
Next on 89.7 WGBH.
Remember the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls? Well, the girls are not back, but the buzz over their kidnapping inspired some Israelis to use social media to draw attention to three missing teenage boys.
Those terrorists who have kidnapped our kids, you better bring them back.
Hashtag Bring Back Our Boys plus the latest on Iraq, that's on the world.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Northeastern University, where researchers are untangling the complexities of climate change to measure the true cost to the world's cities. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers and appraisers, supporting American Public Media's business and economic news show, Marketplace, weekdays from 6 to 6:30 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH.
Hello, I'm John Abbott, president of WGBH. June is a great time to celebrate everything that's good in our community, the strength and power of our city and region, and all that it has to offer. And when you make a gift to WGBH before the first day of summer, we'll make sure to keep you updated on what and who will be coming to town this season, along with plenty of invitations to be our guest at everything, from big summer shows to private tastings with some of the region's best chefs. It's going to be a great summer, made even better by your support. Here's someone to tell you more.
You got to really move fast.
What an inspiring afternoon. I'm Kim Saltmarsh. It is our final Friday of our June fundraiser, the most important fundraiser of the entire year. It is your final chance to support Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. I am honored to say that we started out needing to hear from 100 people. We are now down to 29. We just need to hear from you and 28 others in the next 20 minutes supporting on your final chance to support Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. So many amazing incentives today to get involved. You know, I don't want to call this breaking news, but we have a breaking fundraising update, if you will. We have 10 pairs of Moth tickets. They just showed up. If you want to see the Moth live, write this down. October 16th. It's a Thursday at 7 p.m. here at the Wilbur Theater in Boston. You can be there for a gift of $180. We will send you two tickets to the Moth. These, I swear, we blinked and they were gone. So if you want to take advantage of these, see the Moth, they will go very, very quickly now. You have 19 minutes to take advantage of the 10 pairs that just popped up to the Moth. We still have Pat Benatar tickets. $200 gets you two free tickets to that. Boston, the last 63 years, it's an amazing flash drive. But at the end of the day, you are supporting a show that you rely on, that you listen to, that's a part of the fabric of who you are. Look, we have a deficit. We still have about $65,000 to raise today, and we will not raise that without your help. We have to raise it today. 888-897-9424 or online at WGBHnews.org. So many people have been getting involved, right, Jim?
They have. And, you know, Kim said 29 left. And Marjorie and I don't want to guilt trip you, but there is a jaws of life warming up outside the studio if we don't get to 29. We want to thank Smitty in Arlington, Mary in Milford, Mass., Kara in Westboro, Joanna in Brewster, Mark in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, Beverly in Avon, Connecticut, James in Townsend. I can't tell you, I mean this sincerely, how much this means to us. Please call if you haven't already. 888-897-9424 or WGBHnews.org. Everybody, this is our June fundraiser. It is the most important one of the year. It's a time when all our programs pass through their final review. Right now, more than ever, you really can make a personal difference in this community. We're a little bit short, not much time left. When you make a gift before the first day of summer, we'll make sure to update you on everything going on in Boston this summer, along with plenty of discounts and special invitations to events, GBH and others. 888-897-9424 or give online at WGBHnews.org.
Plus, you feel really, really good when you give. I remember long before I ever dreamed I'd be working here, I gave for the first time to to WGBH, and I felt like I was really contributing to something I adored. And it is really easy because you're supporting the best storytelling. All you have to do is call up 888-897-9424 or go online at WGBHnews.org. And when you listen to us and when you tune into the television set, you feel like you have done your part. It feels great.
It feels so great. And I'm thrilled and so great to say that it's 28 now. We need 28 people in the remaining 17 minutes. That's just you and 27 others doing your part on Final Friday. Your final chance to support Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. We need to hear from you. We have a deficit. We have a budget gap we need to fill. I would never interrupt this program. I would never interrupt this program if we didn't really need your help. It is vital right now. 28 people to go, 17 minutes to go. New England is rallying. You are rallying. Let's hear from you now. 888-897-9424 and WGBHnews.org.
I am Lori. I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I've never lived in the Boston area. The first thing I did was unpack my radio and then tune it in to WGBH. I think I started listening the day that Jim and Marjorie began on air, and so I've learned a lot from listening to their program. I believe it's important for listeners of public broadcasting to become a sustainer because it's easy, right? Also by doing a monthly contribution, it's just a small chunk out of your monthly expenses, and I think it's just important to support the programming that you utilize, so that's why I do it.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. It's time for our Friday News Quiz. I love this. It's a special edition. We have two listeners turn contestants. A few weeks ago, Lori Burgoyne called in. We were taking calls on tattoos. Lori owns the Electric Butterfly Tattoo.
And
what's that?
Electric Angel.
Oops, I'm sorry. Electric Angel. Thank goodness you're
that's
here to correct
much,
me, Lori.
That's a much better name.
As I was saying, Electric Angel Tattoo in Brookline, New Hampshire. Lori, it's great to meet you.
How are you, Lori?
Get a little closer to the mic, Lori, if you would. I'm going to get this guy right, I hope. We're also joined by Chris Padgett. I got that right, Chris?
So far, so good.
Thank goodness. He called in that day because he's put together this fabulous photo exhibit that everybody's talking about called Bled for Boston. It documents all the tributes people made in the aftermath of Boston Marathon bombing by way of tattoos. His photos are now in a book. 25% of the sale of each book benefits the Great Spalding Rehab. Chris, it's great to meet you, too.
You as well. Thanks.
And by the way, your stuff is absolutely moving and spectacular.
You.
It is really, really great.
Well, tell us before we get to the other side of the table. I saw some of the tattoos. One guy has the entire skyline of Boston tattooed on his arm.
That's Joe.
Tell us about some of the other ones.
Oh, man. There were a lot of skylines, a lot of Bruins bees, spoked bees, a lot of Red Sox bees. My personal favorite was a mother-daughter duo who got this special place, the State of Grace, from Obama's speech. The daughter came home with it on her forearm. Mom freaked out. And then a few days later, she realized that's actually kind of cool, and she got it on her side.
Oh, that is too great.
I love that.
And by the way, it's
that.
bledforboston.com still, right?
That's correct, yep.
And now, Lori, when did you change the name of your organization from Electric Butterfly? So Electric Angel, by the way, the thing on your arm.
It's beautiful.
Just,
it's beautiful.
Describe what that is for
well,
a second.
Well, it's, I have blackberries. I have a bracelet of leaves and then blackberries and flowers, and there's a little bitty spider hanging off, and then snow pea vines. And
totally
that,
beautiful.
That goes up to a praying
mantis.
And he's just holding a butterfly.
By the way, we're going to take a picture of that, our colleagues, before you leave, if it's okay with you,
sure.
And we'll put it online. I read this morning, in 1999, 21% of Americans had a tattoo.
Yeah.
It's double that, 40%.
Yep, easy.
6 out of 10 millennials, 18 to 34-year-olds, have them. Why the explosion, do you think?
I don't know, but I feel like it was one of those things in my life that I hit the crest just right, as the wave was rising, I went right with it, and It's been just for me.
And the stigma is pretty much, I mean, other than getting something like on your hand or your neck or your face,
you
the stigma
to,
is pretty much
you
gone,
You do have
right?
to think about, there are still people out there that are hesitant when they see somebody with a tattoo, especially in certain professions. But, yeah, as long as you think about the placement and you think about your life, yeah, just about anybody.
You ready to do
okay,
quiz,
ready
you
to
guys?
Go? Ready to go?
Who are you going to ask questions of, Marjorie?
I'll start with Lori. Girl, girl, boy, boy.
Fair enough.
Here's Conan O'Brien weighing in on some international news right
Several
here.
Protesters at the got into trouble for burning American flags. Yeah. It's a shame because children in China worked very hard to make those flags.
Okay. Here's the question, Lori. What event did these protesters use as an opportunity to burn the American flag?
The American flag?
Yeah, it was a thing, that big event that happened this week.
Well, the World Cup.
The World Cup.
Well, the World Cup.
That is it. Very good.
Do you have World Cup fever, Lori?
Well, I did. I did watch to see, you know, when the U.S. played, whether they won or not, and they did.
They did. They're playing Sunday again.
Portugal.
Very good.
Yeah.
You into this or no? The World Cup deal? One honest man in the crowd.
Yeah, I've tried.
I know, so do I. Okay, Chris, here's your question.
Okay.
Earlier this week, we spoke with TV scholar from Syracuse University, Bob Thompson. Here's his assessment of a televised event that happened 20 years ago this week. What is he describing?
What kind of car chase goes on at 43 miles per hour? I may be remembering this wrong, and forgive me if I am, but I really seem to remember at one point that Bronco changes lanes and it uses its turning. And to me, that is sort of a mind-exploding moment when we talk about you know, the ending of the 20th century, when this huge mythological story is happening and they use their turn signals.
I love Bob Thompson. What event was he describing there, Chris Padgett?
That was the O.J. car chase.
Do you remember? You're correct. You watch it?
Wow,
do you remember
you.
Watching it?
Yeah, I was in a restaurant with my girlfriend at the time, and I looked up, and it was just a TV on in the corner, and I thought, what in the world? Why a white Bronco? And then I got home and figured it out.
You know what we both learned this week? 90 million people that year watched the Super Bowl. 95 million watched some part of the Bronco chase. Is that unbelievable?
Pizza orders went up. It was nuts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's 1-1 at the end of one round. Take it away, Marjorie.
Okay, here we go, Lori. Listen to Jimmy Fallon commemorate a TV milestone here.
Has broken a world record for a game show host after hosting 6,829 shows in his career.
Wow.
When asked how he's made it through so many shows, was like, what is scotch? Scotch whiskey.
Okay, do you know who Jimmy Fallon is talking about, having hosted all those game shows?
Who is Alex Trebek?
You are correct. That is right. Jeopardy host Alex Trebek. That is great.
When I was a kid, I wanted to grow up to be Alex Trebek. I'm not joking, and it's not too late, Jim. Don't be worried. Okay, here's your chance, Chris Padgett, to tie this thing up. You ready?
I'm ready.
A special NBC News correspondent was the cause of outrage when the world learned that she earned a whopping $600,000 for delivering a handful of puff pieces. Here's a clip from one of her pieces where she embedded with clothing designer Stella McCartney, by the way, the daughter of you-know-who. Who is this news correspondent?
And Stella invited her friends to join her in the rain. Amy Poehler and Naomi Watts, Madonna, and Cameron Diaz. Notable names have always been a part of Stella's life.
Okay, who is the news correspondent making $600,000 for very little reporting?
I have no clue.
I'm going to give you a clue since Marjorie gave Lori a clue. She is related to two of the most powerful people on the planet.
That, I would assume, is a Clinton.
And who would that be then?
That's...
Obviously, her reporting had a huge impact on you.
Yeah, clearly.
Exactly.
Bill and Hillary's daughter, Chelsea.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Did you notice how much she sounds like her mother?
Oh, she does.
I mean, it's unbelievable. The voice is so similar.
I was a little thrown because she sounds much older than she is.
Yeah, how old is she? Like 32?
Maybe?
33?
By the way, I interviewed her a couple of years ago. She was terrific. I mean, as light as a feather as some of these reports are.
Oh, she's really smart.
She's really smart, but she's not worth $600,000. We're talking our contestants today. They were callers, come contestants. Chris Padgett from bledforboston.com. These great photos where people have tattooed themselves or had tattoos done in tribute to the good things out of... I didn't mean that, of course. out of the marathon bombing, and Lori Burgoyne, whose place is Electric Angel. Tattoo.
You know, I have a quick question for Lori, because I have a couple of children who are very interested in tattoos, and I've tried to emphasize you've got to go to a really good tattoo artist. How do you find that out? Is it just word
That's
of mouth?
That's a good question.
Most of my business is by word of mouth.
Yeah.
And I think over the years, places develop reputations, and I think going by a place that has a good reputation, that says a lot.
And you, by the way, how'd you get in? Obviously, your interest was not just the good that came out of the bad on Marathon Monday. But obviously you're into tattoos, I assume, too, Chris Padgett. Are you not?
I have a few. I have five, and I'd gone in to get this one from my friend Melissa at
Good
Mojo in Beverly.
That is neat. That's
with
Boston.
A Sitka sign there also.
Yeah. That's fun.
That's pretty good. I like that.
And I just saw a lot of people coming in and out. They were doing $50 or $100 tattoos and donating all the money to the one fund.
That's great.
And I just saw people coming in and out, and it was just an interesting mix of folks that were coming in. And I pitched it to her, and it was going to be this little thing on the North Shore of me taking pictures and her putting them up in the shop. And next thing I know, I'm here.
Great project. Well, here's where we're going to go right to the bonus round that is tied 2-2. Since tattooing is the common denominator, obviously, we're going to ask you about the other tattoo. And that, of course, would be the sidekick to Ricardo Montalban's Mr. Rourke in the TV series Fantasy Island. To jog your memory, Tattoo was famous, of course, for this. Can't believe we played that. In any case,
first time
Marjorie, let's switch and you can
I'll
go
do
to Chris first.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Okay, these are really hard questions too, so don't be upset about them. As you've heard at the beginning of each episode, Tattoo would run up the main bell tower to ring the bell and shout, "The plane, the plane, the plane," to announce
good,
the arrival
Marjorie.
Of the new set of guests. Later on, the series, this ritual was replaced with multiple choice. A, Tattoo riding a go-kart to greet the new guests. B, Tattoo setting off fireworks to signal that guests had arrived. Or C, Tattoo sitting in the island's command central using radar technology and an intercom system to announce that the guests had arrived. Do you have any idea, Chris?
I mean, I was 4 when this show was on.
I'm sorry, there are no excuses on the Friday news quiz.
You know, I'm gonna go with C, the radar control room.
It's an excellent guess.
Excellent guess.
I'd be wrong.
Is not correct.
Ah!
Do you have any idea, Lori?
A or B?
I'm a touch older. I think it was the go kart.
You are correct.
Right. Yes.
Really? Go kart.
Now you can expand your lead. Essentially, not only expand your lead, win the whole thing. If you get it wrong, it's a tie. If you get it right, you win. Lori Burgoyne, you ready?
Okay.
Question 2: The actor who played Tattoo, Hervé. I hope I pronounced right. Hervé Jean-Pierre Villechaize. Thank you very much, Chris. Give Chris a half point for that. Was born and raised in Paris. What distinction did he earn at the tender age of 18? A. An apprenticeship at the famous restaurant Maxime's. B. He showed his paintings at the Beaux-Arts Museum in Paris. C, he won a Palme d'Or for Best Silent Film Short. All the marbles on this one. You get it right, you win. You get it wrong, it's a tie. What's the deal? A, B, or C? Maxime's, Beaux-Arts, or Palme d'Or? Which is it?
I'll go with Palme d'Or.
You would go incorrectly because it is Beaux-Arts and it ends up a tie, as it should. Should it not? Of course it should.
Yeah.
Lori Burgoyne, how do we find you?
The best way is just straight at Gmail, electricangeltattoo@gmail.com.
And you're in Brookline, New Hampshire,
I'm
correct?
In Brookline, New Hampshire.
And how about you? Bledforboston.com.
Bledforboston.com. You can order copies of the book there, see all the pictures, all the people that participated.
You did a fantastic job.
Thank
the
you.
Pictures are really, they're really great. I mean, it really makes you feel good.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you both. And nobody's going to ask Marjorie what the tattoo she has is of, or you're not going to bother asking her?
Well, I don't have
You don't?
One. No, I don't. Do you?
Well, I wouldn't say on the air, Marjorie.
Obviously. You have life across your shoulders?
Exactly.
Your
that's
yeah.
funny. How'd you know? Have yeah, I seen you at the... Exactly.
What did he say? You have Anchorman across your shoulders?
But it doesn't matter. Hey, Chris and Lori, it's great to meet you. Thank you so much, both of you.
Okay, Lori Burgoyne owns the Electric Angel Tattoo in Brookline, New Hampshire. You can check her out online at electricangeltattoo.com. It's not .com, is it?
.com's the website, but...
Email her.
Okay.
Email.
All right. And Christopher Padgett is a photographer. To learn more about his book, Bled for Boston, go to bledforboston.com. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Before we go, we're going to talk a little bit to Kim Saltmarsh about our fundraising.
Hey, we have just 2 minutes left, 3 three people to go. We now have a deficit of $60,000 to raise today. You did that. You raised $10,000 today. There are still like two pairs of Moth tickets. I hope you get in on it. 888-897-9424 and online at WGBHnews.org. We cannot do this without you. 2 minutes to go. Three people to go. 888-897-9424 and WGBHnews.org. Let's do it.
I want to ask you to please tune in on Monday. We're going to have a great show with John Fish, the man who's leading the charge to bring the Olympics to Boston. We're also going to talk politics. I am Marjorie Egan. He is Jim Browdy. Is that who you are?
I am. And we really urge you, as Kim has said, it means a lot to us. It means a lot to everybody at GBH and a lot to this whole community. We hope you agree. Please contribute and please do it now.
Our team, Chelsea Merez, Will Rosen, Amanda McGowan, Alan Mattis, and Devin Karambulis, thank you very much. Thank you for tuning in. And please tune in again on Monday.